that don't know me, I'd like to take this occasion to, since I can't thank you individually, to thank you collectively for the many, many kind compliments I've had on my necktie. A solid consensus, I think it's fair to say, has emerged that it is protected by the First Amendment, even on the narrowest construction. And I'm glad that you all so ringingly uphold the distinction between the truly obscene and the merely tasteless. Actually, I'm a real Second Amendment man in the sense that when I hear the First Amendment mentioned, I reach for my pistol. I've often wondered why every time a pornographer is acquitted, we hear that it's a great vindication of the First Amendment, but when a murderer is acquitted, we never hear it's a great vindication of the Second Amendment. It seems to me to follow in a certain sense. Anyway, the former Justice Potter Stewart, before he was through making mischief, if he is through, said that the press was the only industry protected constitutionally. Now, that suggests to me a very curious view, not only of the First Amendment, but of the Constitution. It suggests, for one thing, that he's never read the Ninth and Tenth Amendments very carefully or reflected on them. It's self-evidently a good thing to hear people talk if the First Amendment protections, as they're called, are expanded. Now, again, that seems to me an odd idea. If you have a right, it should be rather fixed. It should not be expanded or contracted. If it's expanded, then something is lost elsewhere in the system of rights, I should think. If the right to libel others is expanded, the right to be safe from libel is diminished. That's logic, as Tweedledee says. The Second Amendment, you'll notice, I think it's very interesting always to compare these two. The Second Amendment is not treated the same way. We don't hear calls for the expansion of the Second Amendment. You know, I've never heard of a court striking down laws against switchblades or bazookas to the applause of the ACLU. There's a more profound relation between them, I think. The First Amendment is a limitation on Congress, explicitly. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, and so on. Now, under the incorporation doctrine, the court has held, little by little, that the states may not infringe freedom of speech or of the press either. By the same token, then, it would seem that the Second Amendment should be expanded to apply to the states as the First Amendment is. The Second Amendment says, I didn't bother to reread it, but I think I remember it fairly well, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the safety of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Liberals love to mention the proviso of a well-regulated militia, but that proviso should have been affected by the incorporation doctrine in the same way that Congress shall make no law was affected by the same doctrine, I should think, in reason, and that as Wilmore Kendall put it, the First Amendment is a state's rights, not an individual rights document. It leaves the regulation of religion, press, and so forth to the states. By the same token, the Second Amendment is a kind of state's rights amendment because it leaves the regulation of the right to keep and bear arms to the states. Now, if the prerogative is taken from the states by the incorporation doctrine with respect to the First Amendment, it ought to be with the Second Amendment, too, if you follow me. Anyway, one of those things that's always baffled me. And I never resolved the the problem to my satisfaction until I realized that all these liberals are just a bunch of commies. That seemed to me to cover everything. It has the simplicity and elegance of any good theory. Well, the other day, some of you may have seen an interview with Dan Rather, reported in the New York Times. He spoke to a bunch of New York Times reporters and editors. They complained about criticism and pressure from the White House. Now, criticism, I thought, was okay. I mean, I thought that's what the media were in business for, and I thought criticism was really the essence of the civil society, in a sense, at one level. And to confuse or to link criticism and pressure as if they were the same kind of thing struck me as odd. So I thought, what kind of pressure? And I read on, and it said, he added that even criticism, coming so frequently as it does from the White House, becomes a kind of pressure. There's no threat of censorship or prior restraint or anything like that. Just phone calls sometimes before a story was produced, trying to influence the coverage of the story. Well, these things do happen. Demonstrators try to influence the coverage of a story, and they succeed. ABC has done well, I think, in getting the kind of coverage it must have wanted for the day after. Well, I think it's appropriate. That's not nice. Now I've got you curious. I was going to say, Alan Cranston has associated himself with this film, The Day After. He looks like The Day After. I apologize, but
go home.
Where was I? Oh, yeah. Anyway, one kind of pressure Rather didn't mention, I thought he should have mentioned, was peer pressure. It's enormously intense in the media. The Lichter Rothman poll that I remember most fondly, and I remember every one I've read very fondly, was the one that appeared in Public Opinion magazine a couple of years ago, in which it was shown that 80% of the media elite in each of the last four presidential elections, from 64 to 76, had voted for the Democratic candidate. When 39% of the country was voting for George McGovern, I think 81% of the top media people were. Tells you something. If you walk through a newsroom, it tells you something. I've had a little direct experience at CBS itself. I've been very well treated there, but I'll tell you, nice as the people are individually, collectively, there is no question what the consensus is there, and you're treated as a sort of curiosity, at least, if you are conservative. When Tom Brokaw gave an interview to Mother Jones magazine a few months ago and said a lot of left-wing things, he was questioned about it by somebody from Accuracy in Media, bless them, and Brokaw wasn't questioned, an NBC executive was, and he said, well, I think it'd be very hard to find anyone in this business who didn't share Mr. Brokaw's views. I think that's a very interesting explanation, or defense, if that's what it is. Even when the media strive for balance, the very categories in which they strive for balance, race and sex, are the liberal categories. They don't try for ideological balance, religious balance, cultural balance, that sort of thing. And it would be interesting to study these, just study the patterns of employment, for instance. You might find what would in other contexts be called a clear pattern of discrimination. There's very little feedback from the customers in this business, and the problem of peer pressure is especially interesting for that reason. The guy who sells hot dogs on the street outside CBS has to give the customers what they like. There's much less direct pressure of that kind on a network. Well, at any rate, Enough from me. Let's hear from our two principal speakers. First, from Mr. Fred Barnes. I'd like to say something in general, though, about before we begin. I see Vlady Plezhinsky right in front, so it's appropriate that I should say this. Both these speakers write for the American Spectator, and I think they both contribute wonderfully and exemplify the tone of that magazine, which I love for one special reason. I always feel that I'm in the best of company when I read The Spectator. It seems to bring out the best, the most relaxed in some extremely talented writers. So I remember Charles Lindbergh once defined a friend as somebody you can take your shoes off with. And I have that nice feeling about the Spectator. It's a magazine you read with your shoes off. You get something wonderfully stimulating and intellectually and lots of fun at the same time. Well, and here are two principal reasons for that. First, Fred Barnes went to the University of Virginia, graduated in 1965, went to the Charleston, South Carolina News and Courier, before studying history briefly as a disgruntled graduate student at George Washington University. Went to the Washington Star, covered the Supreme Court and the White House, then took a year off as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard. In 1979, he joined the Baltimore Sun as national political reporter and also writes, of course, for The Spectator on the press with a keen and witty monthly column. He's married, has three children, and lives a couple of blocks from me. Mr. Fred Barnes.